1 Kings chapter 22, NIV. Before listening to this study of mine, I think I'd recommend you to read the whole chapter, or at least chapter 22 until verse 36. However, this may not be practical at the moment, so I'll read verses 1 to 8 by way of introduction. 22 of 1 Kings. For 3 years there was no war between Aram and Israel. But in the third year, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went down to see the king of Israel. The king of Israel had said to his officials, "Don't you know that Ramoth-Gilead belongs to us, and yet we're doing nothing to retake it from the king of Aram?" So he asked Jehoshaphat, "Will you go with me to fight against Ramoth-Gilead?" Jehoshaphat replied to the king of Israel, "I am as you are. My people as your people, my horses as your horses." But Jehoshaphat also said to the king of Israel, "First seek the counsel of the Lord." So the king of Israel brought together the prophets, about 400 men, and asked them, "Shall I go to war against Ramoth-Gilead, or shall I refrain?" They answered, "Go, for the Lord will give it into the king's hand." But Jehoshaphat asked, awkward creature that he was, "Is there not a prophet of the Lord here whom we can inquire of?" The king of Israel answered Jehoshaphat, "There is still one man through whom we can inquire of the Lord, but I hate him because he never prophesies anything good about me, always bad. He's Micaiah, son of Imlah." "The king shouldn't say that," Jehoshaphat replied. So the king of Israel, of course, calls for Micaiah. Now this basic story, a fascinating one, is not primarily about Micaiah, though he's a grand and true prophet, nor primarily about Ahab. We know a lot about him already, a godless king. Not primarily about Jehoshaphat, a good man, though, as D.R. Davis says, he scored high on piety, but low on sense. And I think we might even go further, for once I heard him spoken of as a fathead, and certainly in this particular case, he behaved like one. No, it's not primarily about that. It's primarily about the special prophets of 1 Kings 22. And what the chapter does is to set out an identikit of these men, and I've done this with 7 points. They're very brief, but I hope you'll find them suggestive. And I'll leave you to work out who they really refer to, if they refer to anybody today. One, these men, these 400, claim to be prophets of the true God. They're not to be confused with the prophets of Asherah and Baal. Davis is very clear about this, and I'll read what he says. "Although the number of Ahab's prophets remind us of the 400 prophets of Asherah, who were probably no shows on Carmel, they are not Asherah or Baal prophets. They are prophets who speak in Yahweh's name," verse 11, "claim to have Yahweh's spirit," verse 24, "promise Yahweh's success," verse 12, "and can, apparently, deliver Yahweh's word," verse 5. One might, he goes on to say, one might surmise that they're prophets connected with the syncretistic Jeroboam cult, with its veneer of Yahwism mixed with bull worship, 1 Kings 12:25, but that's another matter. So the first point about it is these men to be claimed to be promised of the true God, they are not put forward as the prophets of Baal. In summary, these men were establishment figures, prominent in the king's service. Two, these men were in a great majority. Well, here, of course, it's exaggerated, 400 to 1, almost too good to be true. But remember that Ahab is a very bad king, and these are very evil days, and I suppose, therefore, 400 to 1 was correct. But in other times, I think we can expect more faithful men over against those who are spokesmen for the king only. I suggest that what we're being told here is that the true prophet is always likely to be in a minority, and that those who are men-pleasers, king-pleasers, whatever you like to call them, will always be in a majority. Three, these men were agents of the community. John Gray has got a commentary on one or two kings. I'm by no means a fan of Dr. Gray, but there is an illuminating passage on this in his commentary. I'm quoting, "The respective attitudes of the King of Israel and Jehoshaphat to Micaiah introduce us to the main conceptions of prophecy in ancient Israel. The former employed the prophets as agents of imitative magic, in word, and in the case of Zedekiah, in symbolic action. And there was a whole corps of prophets willing to give him the moral support he needed and required. Jehoshaphat, at least by implication, regarded the prophet not as an agent of the community in its efforts to influence God by autosuggestion, but as, I quote again, the instrument of the revelation of the will of God to the community. This passage significantly anticipates the difference, and indeed antipathy, between the great figures of prophecy, such as Amos, and the other canonical prophets, those termed by them false prophets, which is so accentuated in Jeremiah and the false prophets, Jeremiah 23, whom von Rad sees as an official prophet, circumscribed by his office of intercession and reassurance, and limited by a merely national outlook, as against Jeremiah, whose experience of divine revelation made him independent of institutionalism and turned his vision outward to the action of God in world history." I think the key phrases here are as follows. On the one hand, we have those who are independent of institutionalism over against the agents of community. I was thinking on this of chaplains to the forces, not least in wartime. In a sense, they have to be both. They have to be agents of the community. They have to help their soldiers. They have to do all sorts of things to comfort them and assist them. But at the same time, if they're true chaplains, they have to be independent of institutionalism and speak the word of God to the soldiers under their care and not simply be agents of the community. Put this again in this way. On the one hand are instruments of the revelation of the will of God, and on the other, those whose priority is to give moral support to the community as it is required. Again, you can see that there can be something of both in a minister's work. He supports the community, marriages, burials, and so on. Nevertheless, at the same time as supporting the community, he must be an instrument of the revelation of the will of God. Fourth, these men, these 400 men of chapter 22, are preachers of good news. And here is the good news in verse 6. "Shall I go to war against the Ramoth-Gilead, or shall I refrain? Go, they said, for the Lord will give it into the king's hands." And all the prophets were prophesying the same thing. "Attack Ramoth-Gilead and be victorious," they said, "for the Lord will give it into the king's hands." So it's a unanimous testimony, even showing some contempt for Micaiah and people of that ilk, such as when Zedekiah, the son of Kenaniah, went up and slapped Micaiah in the face and said, "Which way did the spirit from the Lord go when he went from me to speak to you?" In other words, you're a nobody. I'm a man who speaks from God. So these men forth were preachers of good news, with authority and contemptuous of Micaiah. Fifthly, these men fit into society. I've got verse 13 to quote here. "The messenger," I don't know who this messenger was, but he suddenly comes into the story. "The messenger who'd gone to summon Micaiah said to him, 'Look, As one man, the other prophets are predicting success for the king. Let your word agree with theirs and speak favorably. That's our modern echo, isn't it? Here is someone who wants conformity. Why don't you join in? Why don't you say the same? Why doesn't your word agree with these? Why don't you speak favorably? To which, of course, old Makar replies, as surely as the Lord lives, I can tell him only what the Lord tells me. 6. These men are nevertheless judged by the Lord. And here I must read from verse 17. After the king had said to him, "How many times must I make you swear to tell me nothing but the truth?" Micah had hitherto told him what he wanted to hear. Micah then answered, "I saw all Israel scattered on the hills like sheep without a shepherd. And the Lord said, 'These people have no master, let each one go home in peace.'" The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "Didn't I tell you that he never prophesies anything good about me, but only bad?" Micaiah continued, "Therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, with all the host of heaven standing round him on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, 'Who will entice Ahab into attacking Ramoth-Gilead and going to his death there?' And one suggested this and another that. Finally, a spirit came forward, stood before the Lord, and said, 'I will entice him.' 'By what means?' the Lord asked. 'I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets,' he said. 'You will succeed in enticing him,' said the Lord. 'Go and do it.'" So now the Lord put a lying spirit into the mouth of these prophets. That's so powerful, isn't it? It's not a comfortable word. And we find something similar in the New Testament, that when people are determined to go against the word and will of God, God hands them over to their own way. It's quite terrifying, isn't it, that the Lord will give to these prophets a lying spirit to deceive Ahab and all who want to listen in this particular way. So, these men are judged by the Lord in a quite alarming and terrifying way. 7, and last, these men ultimately hide from God's anger. Let me read from verse 24, and this is even more frightening. "Then Zedekiah, son of Kenaiah, went up and slapped Micaiah in the face, which way did the spirit from the Lord go when he went from me to speak to you?" he asked. Micaiah replied, "You will find out on the day you go to hide in an inner room." You will find on the last day when you go to hide in an inner room. Listen to Revelation chapter 6, verse 15. "Then the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and every slave and every free man hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they called on the rocks and the mountains, 'Fall on us, hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand it?'" That ultimately is the fate of these men. Now, I don't really want to say more than give those 7 headings of these prophets of the Lord who spoke over against Micaiah, were popular in a majority, whom the king listened to, and even Jehoshaphat. As a result, they went to ultimate tragedy. I want to leave the word of God to do its own work, and for you to go on considering these 7 headings, and ask yourself a simple question. Does this lie simply in the past? Is this a typical Old Testament story that we can leave there? Or are there similarities today amongst the prophets who call themselves the prophets of the Lord, so that we may divide them on the way in which we divide these men from faithful Micaiah?